policemen behind them. Mr. Curran shakes their hand, then sweeps his hand toward us as we step off the train. I want to say something to Dutchie, but I can't think of what. My hands are clammy. It's a terrible kind of anticipation, not knowing what we're walking into. The last time I felt this way, I was in the waiting rooms at Ellis Island. We were tired and Mam wasn't well, and we didn't know where we were going or what kind of life we would have. But now I can see all I took for granted. I had a family. I believed that whatever happened, we'd be together. A policeman blows a whistle and holds his arm in the air, and we understand that we're to line up. The solid weight of Carmine is in my arms, his hot breath, slightly sour and sticky from his morning milk, on my cheek. Thus he carries our bags. "Quickly, children," Mrs. Scatcherd says, "in two straight lines. That's good." Her tone is softer than usual, and I wonder if it's because we're around other adults or because she knows what's next. "This way." We proceed behind her up a wide stone staircase, the clatter of our hard-soled shoes on the steps echoing like a drum roll. At the top of the stairs, we make our way down a corridor lit by glowing gas lamps and into the main waiting room of the station. Not as majestic as the one in Chicago, but impressive nonetheless. It's big and bright, with large, multi-paned windows. Up ahead, Mrs. Scatcherd's black robe billows behind her like a sail. People point and whisper, and I wonder if they know why we're here. And then, I spot a broadside affixed to a column. In black, block letters on white papers, it reads, "Wanted. Homes for Orphan Children. A company of homeless children from the East will arrive at Milwaukee Road Depot, Friday, October 18. Distribution will take place at 10 a.m. These children are of various ages and both sexes, having been thrown friendless upon the world." "What did I say?" Dutchie says, following my glance. "Pig slops." "You can read?" I ask with surprise, and he grins. As if someone has turned a crank in my back, I am propelled forward, one foot in front of the other. The cacophony of the station becomes a dull roar in my ears. I smell something sweet, candy apples, as we pass a vendor's cart. The hair on my neck is limp, and I feel a trickle of sweat down my back. Carmine is impossibly heavy. How strange, I think, that I am in a place my parents have never been and will never see. How strange that I am here, and they are gone. I touch the clad across around my neck. The older boys no longer seem so rough. Their masks have slipped. I see fear on their faces. Some of the children are sniffling, but most are trying very hard to be quiet, to do what's expected of them. Ahead of us, Mrs. Scatcherd stands beside a large oak door, hands clasped in front of her. When we reach her, we gather around in a semicircle, the older girls holding babies and the younger children holding hands, the boys' hands stuffed in their pockets. Mrs. Scatcherd bows her head. "Mary, Mother of God, we beseech you to cast a benevolent eye over these children, to guide them and bless them as they make their way in the world. We are your humble servants in his name. Amen." "Amen," the pious few say quickly, and the rest of us follow. Mrs. Scatcherd takes off her glasses. "We have reached our destination. From here, the Lord willing, you will disperse to families who need you and want you." She clears her throat. "Now remember, not everyone will find a match right away. This is to be expected and nothing to worry about. If you do not match now, you will simply board the train with Mr. Curran and me, and we will travel to another station about an hour from here. And if you do not find placement there, you will come with us to the next town." The children around me move like a skittish herd. My stomach is hollow and trembly. Mrs. Scatcherd nods. "All right, Mr. Curran, are we ready?"
"We are, Mrs. Scatcherd,"
he says, and leans against the large door with his shoulder, pushing it open. We're at the back of a large, wood-paneled room with no windows, filled with people milling about in rows of empty chairs. As Mrs. Scatcherd leads us down the center aisle toward a low stage at the front, a hush falls over the crowd. And then a swelling murmur. People in the aisle move aside to let us pass. "Maybe, I think, someone here will want me. Maybe I'll have a life I've never dared to imagine, in a bright, snug house where there is plenty to eat, warm cake and milky tea with as much sugar as I please." But I am quaking as I make my way up the stairs to the stage. We line up by height, smallest to tallest, some of us still holding babies. Though Dutchie is 3 years older than me, I'm tall for my age, and we're only separated by one boy in the line. Mr. Curran clears his throat and begins to make a speech. Looking over at him, I notice his flushed cheeks and rabbity eyes, his droopy brown moustache and bristly eyebrows, the stomach that protrudes from the bottom of his vest like a barely hidden balloon.
"A simple matter of paperwork," he tells the good people of Minnesota, "is all that stands between you and one of the children on this stage. Strong, healthy, good for farm work and helping around the house. You have the chance to save a child from destitution, poverty, and I believe Mrs. Scatcherd would agree that it is not too great an exaggeration to add sin and depravity."
Mrs. Scatcherd nods.
"So, you have the opportunity both to do a good deed and get something in return,"
he continues.
"You will be expected to feed, clothe, and educate the child until the age of 18, and provide a religious education as well, of course. And it is our deepest hope that you will grow to feel not only fondness for your child, but to embrace him as your own. The child you select is yours for free," he adds, "on a 90-day trial, at which point, if you so choose, you may send him back."
The girl beside me makes a low noise like a dog's whine and slips her hand into mine. It's as cold and damp as the back of a toad. "Don't worry. We'll be all right," I begin. But she gives me a look of such desperation that my words trail off. As we watch people line up and begin to mount the steps to the stage, I feel like one of the cows in the agricultural show my granddad took me to in Kinvara. In front of me now stands a young blonde woman, slight and pale, and an earnest-looking man with a throbbing Adam's apple and wearing a felt hat. The woman steps forward.
"May I?"
"Excuse me," I say, not understanding. She holds out her arms. Oh, she wants carmine. He looks at the woman before hiding his face in the crook of my neck. "He's shy," I tell her. "Hello, little boy," she says. "What's your name?" He refuses to lift his head. I jiggle him. The woman turns to the man and says softly, "The eyes can be fixed, don't you think?" And he says,
"I don't know. I would reckon so."
Another man and woman are watching us. She's heavy set with a furrowed brow and a soiled apron, and he's got thin strips of hair across his bony head.
"What about that one?"
the man says, pointing at me.
"Don't like the look of her,"
the woman says with a grimace.
"She don't like the look of you neither,"
Dutchie says, and all of us turn toward him in surprise. The boy between us shrinks back.
"What did you say?"
the man goes over and plants himself in front of Dutchie.
"Your wife's got no call to talk like that."
Dutchie's voice is low, but I can hear every word.
"You stay out of it,"
the man says, lifting Dutchie's chin with his index finger.
"My wife can talk about you orphans any way she goddamn wants."
There's a rustling, a flash of black cape, and like a snake through the underbrush, Mrs. Scatcherd is upon us.
"What is the problem here?"
Her voice is hushed and forceful.
"This boy talked back to my husband,"
the wife says. Mrs. Scatcherd looks at Dutchie and then at the couple.
"Hans is spirited," she says. "He doesn't always think before he speaks. I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name."
"Barney McCallum. And this here's my wife, Eva."
Mrs. Scatcherd nods.
"What do you have to say to Mr. McCallum, then, Hans?"
Dutchie looks down at his feet. I know what he wants to say. I think we all do.
"Apologize,"
he mumbles without looking up. While this is unfolding, the slim blonde woman in front of me has been stroking Carmine's arm with her finger, and now, still nestled against me, he is looking through his lashes at her.
"Sweet thing, aren't you?"
She pokes him gently in his soft middle, and he gives her a tentative smile. The woman looks at her husband.
"I think he's the one."
I can feel Mrs. Scatcherd's eyes on us. "Nice lady," I whisper in Carmine's ear. "She wants to be your mum."
"Mam,"
he says, his warm breath on my face. His eyes are round and shining. His name is Carmine. Reaching up, I pry his monkey arms from around my neck, clasping them in my hand. The woman smells of roses, like the lush white blooms along the lane at my gram's house. She's as finely boned as a bird. She puts her hand on Carmine's back, and he clings to me tighter. "It's all right," I start, but the words crumble in my mouth.
"No, no, no," Carmine says. "I think I may faint."
"Do you need a girl to help with him?" I blurt. I think wildly, trying to remember what I am good at. Mend clothes and cook. The woman gives me a pitying look.
Oh, child, she says. I am sorry. We can't afford to. We came here for a baby.
I'm sure you'll find. Her voice trails off.
We just want a baby to complete our family.
I push back tears. Carmine feels the change in me and starts to whimper. You must go to your new ma'am, I tell him and peel him off me. The woman takes him awkwardly, jostling him in her arms. She isn't used to holding a baby. I reach out and tuck his leg under her arm.
Thank you for taking care of him, she says.
Mrs. Scatcherd herds the three of them off the stage toward a table covered with forms, Carmine's dark head on the woman's shoulder. One by one, the children around me are chosen. The boy beside me wanders away with a short, round woman who tells him it's high time she has a man around the house. The dog wine girl goes off with a stylish couple in hats. Dutchie and I are standing together quietly when a man approaches with skin as tanned and scuffed as old shoe leather, trailed by a sour-looking woman. The man stands in front of us for a minute, then reaches out and squeezes Dutchie's arm.
What are you doing?
Dutchie says with surprise.
Open your mouth.
I can see that Dutchie wants to haul off and hit him, but Mr. Curran is watching us closely, and he doesn't dare. The man sticks a dirty-looking finger in his mouth. Dutchie jerks his head around.
Ever work as a hay baler?
The man asks. Dutchie stares straight ahead.
You hear me?
No.
No, you didn't hear me?
Dutchie looks at him.
Never worked as a hay baler. Don't even know what that is. What do you think?
The man says to the woman.
He's a tough one, but we could use a kid this size.
I reckon he'll fall in line.
Stepping up to Dutchie, she says, We break horses.
Boys aren't that different.
Let's loan him up,
the man says.
We got a drive ahead of us.
You're all set?
Mr. Curran says, coming toward us with a nervous laugh.
Yep, this is the one.
Well, all right. If you'll just follow me over here, we can sign those papers.
It's just as Dutchie predicted. Coarse country people looking for a field hand. They don't even walk him down off the stage. Maybe it won't be that bad, I whisper.
If he lays a hand on me,
you can get placed somewhere else.
I'm labor,
he says.
That's what I am.
They have to send you to school, he laughs.
And what'll happen if they don't?
He'll make them send you, and then in a few years,
I'll come and find you,
he says. I have to fight to control my voice. Nobody wants me. I have to get back on the train.
Hey, boy! Stop your dallying!
The man calls, clapping his hands so loudly that everyone turns to look. Dutchie walks across the stage and down the steps. Mr. Curran pumps the man's hand, pats him on the shoulder. Mrs. Scatcherd escorts the couple out the door, Dutchie trailing behind. In the doorway, he turns and finds my face. And then he's gone. It's hard to believe, but it's not yet noon. 2 hours have passed since we pulled into the station. There are about 10 adults milling around, and a half dozen train riders left. Me, a few sickly-looking teenage boys, and some homely children. Undernourished, wall-eyed, beetle-browed. It's obvious why we weren't chosen. Mrs. Scatcherd mounts the stage.
All right, children, the journey continues, she says. It is impossible to know what combination of factors makes a child suitable for a certain family, but to be perfectly frank, you would not want to be with a family that doesn't welcome you wholeheartedly. So, though this may not seem like the desired outcome, I tell you that it is for the best. And if, after several more attempts, it becomes clear that...
Her voice wavers.
For now, let's just worry about our next destination. The good people of Albans, Minnesota, are waiting.
Albans, Minnesota, 1929. It's early afternoon when we arrive in Albans, which I can see as we pull up to the depot is barely a town at all. The mayor is standing on the open-air platform, and as soon as we disembark, we are herded in a ragtag line to a grange hall a block from the station. The brilliant blue of the morning sky has faded, as if left out too long in the sun. The air has cooled, I am no longer nervous or worried. I just want to get this over with. There are fewer people here, about 50, but they fill the small brick building. There's no stage, so we walk to the front and turn to face the crowd. Mr. Curran gives a less florid version of the speech he gave in Minneapolis, and people begin to inch forward. They generally appear both poorer and kindlier. The women are wearing country dresses and the men seem uncomfortable in their Sunday clothes. Expecting nothing makes the whole experience easier to bear. I fully believe that I will end up on the train again, to be unloaded at the next town, paraded with the remaining children, and shuttled back on the train. Those of us who aren't chosen will likely return to New York to grow up in an orphanage. And maybe that wouldn't be so bad. At least I know what to expect. Hard mattresses, rough sheets, strict matrons. But also friendship with other girls. 3 meals a day. School. I can go back to that life. I don't need to find a family here. And perhaps it will be for the best if I don't. As I am thinking this, I become aware of a woman looking at me closely. She is about my mother's age, with wavy brown hair cropped close to her head and plain strong features. She wears a high-necked white blouse with vertical pleats, a dark paisley scarf, and a plain gray skirt. Heavy black shoes are on her feet. A large oval locket hangs on a gold chain around her neck. The man standing behind her is stout and florid, with shaggy auburn hair. The buttons of his waistcoat strain to confine his drum-like girth. The woman comes close to me.
What's your name?
Neve.
Eve?
No, Neve. It's Irish, I say.
How do you spell it?
N-I-A-M-H. She looks back at the man, who breaks into a grin.
Fresh off the boat, he says. Ain't that right, missy?
Well, not, I begin, but the man interrupts me.
Where are you from?
County Galway.
Ah, right,
he nods, and my heart jumps. He knows it.
My people are from County Cork. Came over long ago, during the famine.
These two are a peculiar pair. She circumspect and reserved, he bouncing on his toes, humming with energy.
The name would have to change,
she says to her husband.
Whatever you want, my dear.
She cocks her head at me.
How old are you?
9, ma'am.
Can you sew?
I nod.
Do you know how to cross-stitch? Hem. Can you do back-stitching by hand?
Fairly well. I learned stitches sitting in our apartment on Elizabeth Street, helping Mam when she took in extra work darning and mending, and the occasional full dress from a bolt of cloth. Much of her work came from the sisters Rosenblum downstairs, who did fine finish work and gladly passed along to Mam the more tedious tasks. I stood beside her as she traced patterns in chalk on chambray and calico, and I learned to make the wide, simple chain stitches to guide the emerging shape of the garment.
Who taught you?
My Mam.
Where is she now?
Passed away.
And your father?
I'm an orphan. My words hang in the air. The woman nods at the man, who puts his hand on her back and guides her to the side of the room. I watch as they talk. He shakes his floppy head and rubs his belly. He touches the bodice of her blouse with a flat hand, gestures toward me. He stoops, hands on his belt, and bends close to whisper in her ear. She looks me up and down. Then they come back over.
I am Mrs. Byrne, she says. My husband works as a woman's clothier, and we employ several local women to make garments to order. We are looking for a girl who is good with the needle.
This is so different from what I was expecting that I don't know what to say.
I will be honest with you. We do not have any children and have no interest in being surrogate parents. But if you are respectful and hard-working, you will be treated fairly.
I nod. The woman smiles, her features shifting. For the first time, she seems almost friendly.
Good.
She shakes my hand.
We'll sign the papers, then.
The hovering Mr. Curran descends, and we are led to the table where the necessary forms are signed and dated.
I think you'll find that Neve is mature for her years, Mrs. Scatcherd tells them. If she is brought up in a strict, God-fearing household, there's no reason to believe she can't become a woman of substance.
Taking me aside, she whispers,
You are lucky to have found a home. Do not disappoint me, or the society. I don't know if you'll get another chance.
Mr. Byrne hoists my brown suitcase onto his shoulder. I follow him and his wife out of the Grange Hall, down the quiet street, and around the corner to where their black Model A is parked in front of a modest storefront with hand-lettered signs advertising sales. Norwegian sardines in oil, 15 cents. round steak, 36 cents a pound. Wind rustles through the tall, sparse trees that line the road. After laying my suitcase flat in the trunk, Mr. Byrne opens the rear door for me. The interior of the car is black, the leather seats cool and slippery. I feel very small in the back seat. The Byrnes take their places in the front and don't glance back. Mr. Byrne reaches over and touches his wife's shoulder, and she smiles at him. With a loud rumble, the car springs to life, and we set off. The Byrnes are having an animated conversation in the front seat, but I can't hear a word. Several minutes later, Mr. Byrne pulls into the driveway of a modest beige stucco house with brown trim. As soon as he turns off the car, Mrs. Byrne looks back at me and says, "We've decided on Dorothy."
"You like that name?" Mr. Byrne asks.
"For goodness sake, Raymond, it doesn't matter what she thinks," Mrs. Byrne snaps as she opens her car door. "Dorothy is our choice, and Dorothy she will be." I turn the name over in my mind. Dorothy. All right, I'm Dorothy now. The stucco is chipped and paint is peeling off the trim, but the windows are sparkling clean, and the lawn is short and neat. A domed planter of rust-colored mums sits on either side of the steps. "One of your tasks will be to sweep the front porch, steps, and walkway every day until the snow comes, rain or shine," Mrs. Byrne says as I follow her to the front door. "You will find the dustpan and broom inside the hall closet on the left." She turns around to face me, and I nearly bump into her. "Are you paying attention?"
I don't like to repeat myself.
"Yes, Mrs. Byrne.
Call me ma'am."
"Ma'am will suffice."
"Yes, ma'am."
The small foyer is gloomy and dark. Shadows from the white crocheted curtains on every window cast lacy shapes on the floor. To the left, through a slightly open door, I glimpse the red flocked wallpaper and mahogany table and chairs of a dining room. Mrs. Byrne pushes a button on the wall, and the overhead light springs on as Mr. Byrne comes through the front door, having retrieved my bag from the truck.
"Ready?"
she says. Mrs. Byrne opens the door to the right onto a room that, to my surprise, is full of people. Albans, Minnesota, 1929. Two women in white blouses sit in front of black sewing machines with the word SINGER spelled out in gold along the body, pumping one foot on the iron lattice step that moves the needle up and down. They don't look up as we enter, just keep watching the needle, tucking the thread under the foot and pressing the fabric flat. A round young woman with frizzy brown hair kneels on the floor in front of a cloth mannequin, stitching tiny pearls into a bodice. A gray-haired woman sits on a brown chair, perfectly erect, hemming a calico skirt. And a girl, who appears only a few years older than me, is cutting a pattern out of thin paper on a table. On the wall above her head is a framed needlepoint that says, in tiny black and yellow cross-stitching, "Keep me busy as a bee." "Fanny, can you stop a minute?" Mrs. Byrne says, touching the gray-haired woman on the shoulder. "Tell the others."
"Break,"
the old woman says. They all look up, but the only one who changes position is the girl, who puts down her shears. Mrs. Byrne looks around the room, leading with her chin.
"As you know, we have needed extra help for quite some time, and I am pleased to report that we have found it. This is Dorothy."
She lifts her hand in my direction.
"Dorothy, say hello to Bernice," the woman with frizzy hair, "Joan and Sally,"
the women at the Singers,
"Fanny,"
the only one who smiles at me, "and Mary."
"Mary,"
she says to the young girl,
"you will help Dorothy get acquainted with her surroundings. She can do some of your scut work and free you up for other things. And Fanny, you will oversee, as always."
"Yes, ma'am," Fanny says. Mary's mouth puckers, and she gives me a hard look.
"Well then," Mrs. Byrne says, "let's get back to work. Dorothy, your suitcase is in the foyer. We'll discuss sleeping arrangements at supper."
She turns to leave and adds,
"We keep strict hours for mealtimes. Breakfast at 8, lunch at 12, supper at 6. There is no snacking between meals. Self-discipline is one of the most important qualities a young lady can possess."
When Mrs. Byrne leaves the room, Mary jerks her head at me and says,
"Come on, hurry up.
You think I got all day?" Obediently, I go over and stand behind her. "What do you know about stitching?" "I used to help my mom with the mending. Have you ever used a sewing machine?"
"No."
She frowns.
"Does Mrs. Byrne know that?"
"She didn't ask." Mary sighs, clearly annoyed.
"I didn't expect to have to teach the basics."
"I'm a fast learner."
"I hope so."
Mary holds up a flimsy sheet of tissue paper. This is a pattern. Ever heard of it before? I nod and Mary continues, describing the various features of the work I'll be doing. The next few hours are spent doing tasks no one else wants to do. Snipping stitches, basting, sweeping up, collecting pins and putting them in pin cushions. I keep pricking myself and have to be careful not to get blood on the cloth. Throughout the afternoon, the women pass the time with small talk and occasional humming, but mostly they are quiet. After a while, I say, "Excuse me, I need to use the lavatory. Can you tell me where it is?" Fanny looks up. "Reckon I'll take her. My fingers need a rest." Getting up with some difficulty, she motions toward the door. I follow her down the hall, into a spare and spotless kitchen, and out the back door. "This is our privy. Don't ever let Mrs. Byrne kitch you using the one in the house." She pronounces catch, kitch. At the back of the yard, tufted with grass like sparse hair on a balding head, is a weathered gray shed with a slit cut out of the door. Fanny nods toward it. "I'll wait." "You don't have to. The longer you're in there, the longer my fingers get a break." The shed is drafty, and I can see a sliver of daylight through the slit. A black toilet seat, worn through to wood in some places, is set in the middle of a rough-hewn bench. Strips of newspaper hang on a roll on the wall. I remember the privy behind our cottage in Kinvara, so the smell doesn't shock me, though the seat is cold. What will it be like out here in a snowstorm? Like this, I suppose. Only worse. When I'm finished, I open the door, pulling down my dress. "You're pitiful thin," Fanny says. "I'll bet you're hungry."
"Hungry?"
She's right. My stomach feels like a cavern. "A little," I admit. Fanny's face is creased and puckered, but her eyes are bright. I can't tell if she's 70 or 100. She's wearing a pretty purple flowered dress with a gathered bodice, and I wonder if she made it herself. "Mrs. Byrne don't give us much for lunch, but it's probably more'n you had." She reaches into the side pocket of her dress and pulls out a small, shiny apple. "I always save something for later, case I need it." She locks up the refrigerator between meals.
"No," I say.
"Oh, yes, she does. Says she don't want us rooting around in there without her permission. But I usually manage to save something." She hands me the apple. "I can't. Go ahead. You got to learn to take what people are willing to give." The apple smells so fresh and sweet it makes my mouth water.
"You best eat it here, before we go back in."
Fanny looks at the door to the house, then glances up at the second floor windows. "Why don't you take it back in the privy?" As unappetizing as this sounds, I am so hungry I don't care. I step back inside the little shed and devour the apple down to the core. Juice runs down my chin, and I wipe it with the back of my hand. My da used to eat the apple core and all.
"Where all the nutrients are, it's plain ignorant to throw it out," he'd say.
But to me, the hard cartilage is like eating the bones of a fish. When I open the door, Fanny strokes her chin. I look at her, puzzled. "Evidence," she says, and I wipe my sticky jaw. Mary scowls when I step back into the sewing room. She shoves a pile of cloth at me and says, "Pin these." I spend the next hour pinning edge to edge as carefully as I can, but each time I put a completed one down, she grabs it, inspects it hastily, and flings it back at me. "It's a sloppy mess. Do it again." "But don't argue. You should be ashamed of this work." The other women look up and silently return to their sewing. I pull out the pins with shaking hands. Then I slowly re-pin the cloth, measuring an inch apart with a metal sewing gauge. On the mantelpiece, an ornate gold clock with a domed glass front ticks loudly. I hold my breath as Mary inspects my work. "This has some irregularity," she says finally, holding it up. "What's wrong with it?" "It's uneven." She won't look me in the eye. "Maybe you're just..." Her voice trails off.
"What?"
"Maybe you aren't cut out for this kind of work." My bottom lip trembles and I press my lips together hard. I keep thinking someone, maybe Fanny, will step in. But no one does.
"I learned how to sew from my mother. You're not mending a rip in your father's trousers. People are paying good money. I know how to sew," I blurt.
"Maybe better than you." Mary gapes at me.
"You.
You are nothing, she sputters. Don't even have a family. My ears are buzzing. The only thing I can think to say is, and you don't have any manners. I stand up and leave the room, pulling the door shut behind me. In the dark hall, I contemplate my options. I could run away, but where would I go? After a moment, the door opens, and Fanny slips out. Goodness, child, she whispers. Why you have to be so mouthy? That girl is mean. What did I do to her? Fanny puts a hand on my arm. Her fingers are rough, calloused. It don't do you any good to squabble. But my pins were straight. She sighs. Mary's only hurting herself by making you do the work over. She's paid by the piece, so I don't know what she thinks she's doing. But you... Well, let me ask you this. Are they paying you? Paying me? Fanny! A voice rings out above us. We look up to see Mrs. Byrne at the top of the stairs. Her face is flushed. What on earth is going on? I can't tell if she heard what we were saying. Nothing to concern you, ma'am, Fanny says quickly. A little spat between the girls is all. Over what? Honest, ma'am, I don't think you want to know. Oh, but I do. Fanny gazes at me and shakes her head. Well? You seen that boy who delivers the afternoon paper? They got to arguing over whether he has a sweetheart. You know how girls can be. I exhale slowly. The foolishness, Fanny, Mrs. Byrne says. I didn't want to tell you. You two, get back in there. Dorothy? I don't want to hear another word of this nonsense. You understand? Yes, ma'am. There is work to be done. Yes, ma'am. Fanny opens the door and walks ahead of me into the sewing room. Mary and I don't speak for the rest of the afternoon. That night, at supper, Mrs. Byrne serves chopped beef, potato salad, stained pink by beets, and rubbery cabbage. Mr. Byrne chews noisily. I can hear every click of his jaw. I know to put my napkin in my lap. Graham taught me that. I know how to use a knife and fork. Though the beef tastes as dry and flavorless as cardboard, I'm so ravenous that it's all I can do not to shove it into my mouth. Small, ladylike bites, Graham said. After a few minutes, Mrs. Byrne puts down her fork and says, Dorothy, it's time to discuss the rules of the house. As you already know, you are to use the privy in the back. Once a week on Sunday evenings, I will draw a bath for you in the tub in the washroom off the kitchen. Sunday is also wash day, which you'll be expected to help with. Bedtime is at 9 p.m., with lights out. There's a pallet for you in the hall closet. You'll bring it out in the evenings and roll it up neatly in the morning, before the girls arrive at 8:30. I'll be sleeping... in the hallway? I ask with surprise. Mercy, you don't expect to sleep on the second floor with us, do you? She says with a laugh. Heaven forbid. When dinner is over, Mr. Byrne announces that he is going for a stroll. And I have work to do, Mrs. Byrne says. Dorothy, you will clean up the dishes. Pay careful attention to where things belong. The best way for you to learn our ways is to observe closely and teach yourself. Where do we keep the wooden spoons? The juice glasses? It should be a fun game for you. She turns to leave. You are not to disturb Mr. Byrne and me after dinner. You will put yourself to bed at the appropriate time and turn out your light. With a curt smile, she says, we expect to have a positive experience with you. Don't do anything to threaten our trust. I look around at the dishes piled in the sink, the strips of beet peel staining a wooden cutting board, a saucepan half full of translucent cabbage, a roasting pan charred and waxed with grease. Glancing at the door to be sure the burns are gone, I spear a hunk of the flavorless cabbage on a fork and swallow it greedily, barely chewing. I eat the rest of the cabbage this way, listening for Mrs. Byrne's foot on the stairs. As I wash the dishes, I look out the window over the sink at the yard behind the house, murky now in the fading evening light. There are a few spidery trees, their thin trunks flayed into branches. By the time I've finished scrubbing the roasting pan, the sky is dark and the yard has faded from view. The clock above the stove says 7:30. I pour myself a glass of water from the kitchen faucet and sit at the table. It feels too early to go to bed, but I don't know what else to do. I don't have a book to read, and I haven't seen any in the house. We didn't have many books in the apartment on Elizabeth Street either, but the twins were always getting old papers from the newsies. In school, it was poems I liked best, Wordsworth and Keats and Shelley. Our teacher made us memorize the words to Ode on a Grecian Urn, and alone in the kitchen now, I close my eyes and whisper,
Thou still unravished bride of quietness, thou foster child of silence and slow time. But that's all I can remember. I need to look on the bright side, as Graham always said. It's not so bad here. The house is austere, but not uncomfortable. The light above the kitchen table is warm and cheery. The Burns don't want to treat me like a child, but I'm not so sure I want to be treated like one. Work that keeps my hands and mind busy is probably just what I need. And soon, I will go to school. I think of my own home on Elizabeth Street. So different, but truthfully no better than this. Mam in bed in mid-afternoon, in the sweltering heat, lying in her room past dark, with the boys whining for food, and Maisie sobbing, and me thinking I'll go mad with the heat and the hunger and the noise. Da up and gone. At work, he said, though the money he brought home was less each week, and he'd stumble in after midnight reeking of hops. We'd hear him, tramping up the stairs, belting out the Irish national anthem. We're children of a fighting race that never yet has known disgrace, and as we march the foe to face, we'll chant a soldier's song. Then bursting into the apartment, to Mam's shushing and scolding, he'd stand, silhouetted in the grainy light of the bedroom, and though all of us were supposed to be asleep, and pretended to be, we were rapt, awed by his cheer and bravado. In the hall closet, I find my suitcase and a pile of bedding. I unroll a horsehair pallet and place a thin yellowed pillow at the top. There's a white sheet, which I spread on the mattress and tuck around the edges, and a moth-eaten quilt. Before going to bed, I open the back door and make my way to the privy. The light from the kitchen window casts a dull glow for about 5 feet, and then it's dark. The grass is brittle underfoot. I know my way, but it's different at night, the outline of the shed barely visible ahead. I look up into the starless sky. My heart pounds. This silent blackness scares me more than nighttime in the city, with its noise and light. I open the latch and go inside the shed. Afterward, shaking, I pull my knickers up and flee, the door knocking behind me as I run across the yard and up the 3 steps to the kitchen. I lock the door as instructed and lean against it, panting. And then I notice the padlock on the refrigerator. When did that happen? Mr. or Mrs. Byrne must have come downstairs while I was outside. Spruce Harbor, Maine, 2011. Sometime in the second week, it becomes clear to Molly that cleaning out the attic means taking things out, fretting over them for a few minutes, and putting them back where they were, in a slightly neater stack. Out of the 2 dozen boxes she and Vivian have been through so far, only a short pile of musty books and some yellowed linen have been deemed too ruined to keep. I don't think I'm helping you much, Molly says. Well, that's true, Vivian says, but I'm helping you, aren't I? So you came up with a fake project as a favor to me? Or, I suppose, Terry, Molly says, playing along. Doing my civic duty. You're very noble. Sitting on the floor of the attic, Molly lifts the pieces out of a cedar chest one by one. Vivian perched on a wooden chair beside her. Brown wool gloves. A green velvet dress with a wide ribbon sash. An off-white cardigan. Anne of Green Gables. Hand me that book, Vivian says. She takes the hard-bound green volume with gold lettering and a line drawing of a girl with abundant red hair and a chignon on the front and opens it. Ah, yes, I remember, she says. I was almost exactly the heroine's age when I read this for the first time. A teacher gave it to me. My favorite teacher. You know, Ms. Larson. She leafs through the book slowly, stopping at a page here and there. Anne talks so much, doesn't she? I was much shyer than that. She looks up. What about you? Sorry, I haven't read it, Molly says. No, no, I mean, were you shy as a girl? What am I saying? You're still a girl. But I mean, when you were young. Not exactly shy. I was quiet. Circumspect, Vivian says. Watchful. Molly turns these words over in her mind. Circumspect? Watchful? Is she? There was a time, after her father died and after she was taken away, or her mother was taken away, It's hard to know which came first, or if they happened at the same time, that she stopped talking altogether. Everyone was talking at and about her, but nobody asked her opinion, or listened when she gave it, so she stopped trying. It was during this period that she would wake in the night and get out of bed to go to her parents' room, only to realize, standing in the hall, that she had no parents.
"Well, you're not exactly effervescent now, are you?" Vivian says. "But I saw you outside earlier when Jack dropped you off, and your face was..."
Vivian lifts her knobby hands, splaying her fingers, all lit up.
"You were talking up a storm.
Were you spying on me?"
"Of course. How else am I going to find out anything about you?"
Molly has been pulling things out of the chest and putting them in piles. Clothes, books, knickknacks wrapped in old newspaper. But now she sits back on her heels and looks at Vivian. "You are funny," she says. "I've been called many things in my life, my dear, but I'm not sure anyone has ever called me funny." "I'll bet they have. Behind my back, perhaps." Vivian closes the book. "You strike me as a reader. Am I right?" Molly shrugs. The reading part of her feels private, between her and the characters in a book.
"So, what's your favorite novel?"
"I don't know. I don't have one."
"Oh, I think you probably do. You're the type. What's that supposed to mean?"
Vivian spreads a hand across her chest, her pink-tinged fingernails as delicate-seeming as a baby's. "I can tell that you feel things. Deeply." Molly makes a face. Vivian presses the book into Molly's hand.
"No doubt you'll find this old-fashioned and sentimental, but I want you to have it."
"You're giving it to me?"
"Why not?"
To her surprise, Molly feels a lump in her throat. She swallows, pushing it down. How ridiculous. An old lady gives her a moldy book she has no use for, and she chokes up. She must be getting her period. She fights to keep her expression neutral.
"Well, thanks," she says nonchalantly. "But does this mean I have to read it?"
"Absolutely. There will be a quiz," Vivian says. For a while they work in near silence, Molly holding up an item. A sky blue cardigan with stained and yellowed flowers, a brown dress with several missing buttons, a periwinkle scarf, and one matching mitten. And Vivian sighing,
"I suppose there's no reason to keep that."
Then inevitably adding, "Let's put it in the maybe pile." At one point, apropos of nothing, Vivian says,
"So where is that mother of yours anyway?"
Molly has gotten used to this kind of non sequitur. Vivian tends to pick up discussions they started a few days earlier, right where they left off, as if it's perfectly natural to do so.
"Oh, who knows?"
She's just opened a box that, to her delight, looks easy to dispose of. Dozens of dusty store ledgers from the 1940s and 50s. Surely Vivian has no reason to hang on to them. "These can go, don't you think?" she says, holding up a slim black book. Vivian takes it from her and flips through it.
"Well..."
Her voice trails off. She looks up.
"Have you looked for her?"
"No."
"Why not?"
Molly gives Vivian a sharp look. She's not used to people asking such blunt questions. Asking any questions at all, really. The only other person who speaks this bluntly to her is Lori, the social worker, and she already knows the details of her story. And anyway, Lori doesn't ask why questions. She's only interested in cause, effect, and a lecture. But Molly can't snap at Vivian, who has, after all, given her a get-out-of-jail-free card. If free means 50 hours of pointed questions. She brushes the hair out of her eyes. "I haven't looked for her because I don't care."
"Really?"
"Really.
You're not curious at all?"
"Nope. I'm not sure I believe that." Molly shrugs.
"Hmm. Because, actually, you seem kind of... angry."
"I'm not angry. I just don't care." Molly lifts a stack of ledgers out of the box and thumps it on the floor. "Can we recycle these?" Vivian pats her hand.
"I think maybe I'll hang on to this box," she says,
as if she hasn't said that about everything they've gone through so far. "She's all up in my business," Molly says, burying her face in Jack's neck. They're in his Saturn, and she's straddling him in the pushed-back front seat. Laughing, his stubble rough against her cheek, he says,
What do you mean?
He slips his hands under her shirt and strokes her ribs with his fingers. That tickles, she says, squirming.
I like it when you move like that.
She kisses his neck, the dark patch on his chin, the corner of his lip, a thick eyebrow, and he pulls her closer, running his hands up her sides and under her small breasts, cupping them. I don't know a damn thing about her life, not that I care, but she expects me to tell her everything about mine.
Oh, come on. What can it hurt? If she knows a little more about you, maybe she's nicer to you. Maybe the hours go a little faster. She's probably lonely. Just wants someone to talk to.
Molly screws up her face.
Try a little tenderness,
Jack croons. She sighs. I don't need to entertain her with stories about my shitty life. We can't all be rich as hell and live in a mansion. He kisses her shoulder.
So turn it around. Ask her questions.
Do I care? She sighs, tracing her finger along his ear until he turns his head and bites it, takes it in his mouth. He reaches down and grabs the lever, and the seat falls back with a jolt. Molly lands sloppily on top of him, and they both start to laugh. Sliding over to make room for her in the bucket seat, Jack says,
Just do what it takes to get those hours over with, right?
Turning sideways, he runs his fingers along the waistband of her black leggings.
If you can't stick it out, I might have to figure out a way to go to juvie with you. And that would suck for both of us.
Doesn't sound so bad to me. Pushing her waistband down over her hip, he says,
That's what I'm looking for.
He traces the inky black lines of the turtle on her hip. Its shell is a pointy oval, bisected at an angle, like a shield with a daisy on one side and a tribal flourish on the other, its flippers extending in pointy arcs.
What's this little guy's name again?
It doesn't have a name. Leaning down and kissing her hip, he says,
I'm going to call him Carlos.
Why?
He looks like a Carlos, right? See his little head? He's kind of wagging it like, What's up?
Hey, Carlos,
he says in a Dominican-accented falsetto, tapping the turtle with his index finger. What's happening, man? It's not a Carlos. It's an Indian symbol, she says, a little irritated, pushing his hand away.
Oh, come on. Admit it. You were drunk and got this random-ass turtle. It could just as easily have been a heart-dripping blood or some fake Chinese words.
That's not true. Turtles mean something very specific in my culture.
Oh, yeah, warrior princess?
He says.
Like what?
Turtles carry their homes on their backs. Running her finger over the tattoo, she tells him what her dad told her. They're exposed and hidden at the same time. They're a symbol of strength and perseverance.
That's very deep.
You know why? Because I'm very deep.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, she says, kissing him on the mouth. Actually, I did it because when we lived on Indian Island, we had this turtle named Shelley.
Ha, Shelley. I get it.
Yep. Anyway, I don't know what happened to it. Jack curls his hand around her hip bone.
I'm sure it's fine, he says. Don't turtles live like 100 years?
Not in a tank. With no one to feed them, they don't. He doesn't say anything, just puts his arm around her shoulder and kisses her hair. She settles in beside him on the bucket seat. The windshield is fogged and the night is dark, and in Jack's hard-domed little Saturn, she feels cocooned. Protected.
Yeah, that's right. Like a turtle in a shell.
Spruce Harbor, Maine, 2011. No one comes to the door when Molly rings the buzzer. The house is quiet. She looks at her phone. 9:45 a.m. It's a teacher enrichment day and there's no school, so she figured, why not knock out some hours? Molly rubs her arms and tries to decide what to do. It's an unseasonably cool and misty morning, and she forgot to bring a sweater. She took the Island Explorer, the free bus that makes a continuous loop of the island, and got off at the closest stop to Vivian's, about a 10-minute walk. If no one's home, she'll have to go back to the stop and wait for the next bus, which could take a while. But despite the goosebumps, Molly has always liked days like this. The stark gray sky and bare tree limbs feel more suited to her than the uncomplicated promise of sunny spring days. In the little notebook she carries around, Molly has carefully recorded her time. 4 hours one day, two the next. 23 so far. She made an Excel spreadsheet on her laptop that lays it all out. Jack would laugh if he knew, but she's been in the system long enough to understand that it all comes down to documentation. Get your papers in order, with the right signatures and record keeping, and the charges will be dropped, money released, whatever. If you're disorganized, you risk losing everything. Molly figures she can kill at least 5 hours today. That'll be 28, and she'll be more than half finished. She rings the bell again, cups her hands against the glass to peer into the dim hallway. Trying the doorknob, she finds that it turns, and the door opens. "Hello?" she says as she steps inside. And when she gets no response, tries again, a bit louder, as she walks down the hall. Yesterday, before she left, Molly told Vivian that she'd be coming early today, but she hadn't given a time. Now, standing in the living room with the shades drawn, she wonders if she should leave. The old house is full of noises. Its pine floors creak, window panes rattle, flies buzz near the ceiling, curtains flap. Without the distraction of human voices, Molly imagines she can hear sounds in other rooms, bed springs groaning, faucets dripping, fluorescent lights humming, pull chains rattling. She takes a moment to look around, at the ornate mantelpiece above the fireplace, the decorated oak moldings and brass chandelier. Out of the four large windows facing the water, she can see the sine curve of the coastline, the serrated firs in the distance, the glittery amethyst sea. The room smells of old books and last night's fire and, faintly, something savory from the kitchen. It's Friday. Terry must be cooking for the weekend. Molly is gazing at the old hardcovers on the tall bookshelves when the door to the kitchen opens and Terry bustles in. Molly turns. "Hi there." "Ah!" Terry shrieks, clutching the rag she's holding to her chest. "You scared the hell out of me! What are you doing here?"
Well, Molly stammers, beginning to wonder the same thing. "I rang the buzzer a few times, and then I just let myself in.
Vivian knew you were coming?"
"Did she?" "I'm not sure that we settled on an exact..." Terry narrows her eyes and frowns.
"You can't just show up when you feel like it. She's not available any old time."
"I know," Molly says, her face warming. "I'm sorry."
"Vivian would never have agreed to start this early. She has a routine. Gets up at 8 or 9, comes downstairs at 10.
"I thought old people got up early," Molly mumbles.
"Not all old people."
Terry puts her hands on her hips.
"But that's not the point. You broke in."
"Well, I didn't,"
sighing, Terry says. "Jack may have told you I wasn't crazy about this idea. About you doing your hours this way."
Molly nods. Here comes the lecture.
"He went out on a limb for you. Don't ask me why."
"I know. And I appreciate it."
Molly's aware that it's when she's defensive that she gets in trouble. But she can't resist saying, "And I hope I'm proving worthy of that trust."
"Not by showing up unannounced like this, you're not."
"All right." She deserved that.
"What was it the teacher in her legal issues class said the other day? Never bring up a point you don't have an answer for."
"And another thing," Terry continues. "I was in the attic this morning. I can't tell what you're doing up there."
Molly bounces on the balls of her feet, pissed that she's being called out for this thing she can't control, and even more pissed at herself for not convincing Vivian to get rid of things. Of course it looks to Terry like Molly is just twiddling her thumbs, letting the time slide like a government worker punching a clock. "Vivian doesn't want to get rid of anything," she says. "I'm cleaning out the boxes and labeling them."
"Let me give you some advice," Terry says. "Vivian is torn between her heart," and here she again holds the wadded-up rag to her heart, "and her head."
As if Molly might not make the connection, she moves the rag to her head. Letting go of her stuff is like saying goodbye to her life. And that's tough for anybody to do.
"So your job is to make her. Because I promise you this, I will not be happy if you spend 50 hours up there shuffling things around with nothing to show for it."
"I love Jack, but..."
She shakes her head. "Honestly, enough is enough."
At this point, Terry seems to be talking to herself, or possibly to Jack, and there's little Molly can do but bite her lip and nod to show she gets it. After Terry grudgingly allows that it might actually be a good idea to get going earlier today, and that if Vivian doesn't show up in half an hour, maybe she'll go up and rouse her,
She tells Molly to make herself at home. She has work to do.
You've got something to occupy yourself with, right? She says before heading back to the kitchen.
The book Vivian gave Molly is in her backpack. She hasn't bothered to crack it yet, mainly because it seems like homework for a job that's already punishment, but also because she's rereading Jane Eyre for English class. Ironically, the teacher, Mrs. Tate, handed out school-issued copies the week after Molly tried to pilfer it. And that book is huge. It's always a shock to the system to re-enter it. Just to read a chapter, she finds she has to slow down her breathing and go into a trance, like a hibernating bear. All her classmates are complaining about it. Bronte's protracted digressions about human nature, the subplots about Jane's friends at Lowood School, the long-winded, unrealistic dialogue.
Why can't she just tell the freaking story?